Oh yeah, we got a new intro. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. Robin Gaspardi recently did that, so thank you, Robin. Your podcast sticker is in the mail and should reach you shortly. Our guest today is Aaron Bunch. Aaron started fisheries when he first stepped foot on campus at North Carolina State University as an undergraduate student. After several summer jobs and working as a USGS STEP program intern, he found himself avoiding alligators while working in a couple of South Florida natural lakes for his master's degree at the University of Florida. He took a venture back to North Carolina, working on the complicated trophic dynamics of large reservoirs. Aaron then moved out west to Arizona, working in the Grand Canyon on the Colorado River as a research biologist for the majority of his time there. In 2013, he moved back east to serve as the Tidal Rivers project leader in Virginia, until last year when he decided to make a mid-career move and go back to school to pursue a doctorate degree. He is currently at Clemson University working on diadromous fish passage and telemetry. Welcome to the podcast, Aaron.
Hey, thanks for having me, Nick.
From your bio, it sounds like you work on a lot of neat systems across the U.S., being in North Carolina reservoirs to Florida swamps and out to the Grand Canyon, Colorado River, and then to tidal systems in Virginia. Which of those systems that you worked on was your favorite throughout your experiences?
Ooh, favorite. That's hard because they all are special in their own ways. I think the obvious answer is Grand Canyon because of how unique it is to the United States and one of seven wonders of the world. Maybe there's more wonders of the world now, but at one point it was one of the seven wonders of the world. And to say it's amazing is an understatement. It was hard, arduous work. It was a real chore to go out there and try to collect fish under those conditions. A lot of times the work was at night. It varied by project, but it was real meaningful work to me, and I really enjoyed it. And it really gave me a lot of experience working with conflicting fisheries objectives, because on one hand, we were working with the Lees Ferry trout fishery, which is a non-native salmonid right below Glen Canyon Dam, utilizing those cool waters coming from the hypolimnion of the lake above Lake Powell. And so there's this really nice trophy rainbow trout fishery. So on one hand, I'm working on that. And then on the other hand, we're trying to mitigate any predation or impacts from the non-native salmonid to a native cyprinid species, which was the humpback chub, and other native fish in that system. So, and that's kind of a theme that I've worked on throughout my career. I think now more than ever, with different paradigm shifts and shifts towards conservation-oriented approaches, instead of previous mindset of stock as many sport fish as you can. I think those two approaches are blending now in the fisheries world. And so I think fishery scientists and managers are having to answer and work on objectives that are often conflicting. And I think a lot of people listening to this, they're probably shaking their heads yes, that they have to do that on a daily basis. But I'd say Grand Canyon was fun. It was good. Great experience for me and my family to be out west. I really enjoyed South Florida lakes that I was working on my master's work as well. And then the tidal river is real near and dear to my heart because I grew up around coastal estuarine type environments. So, it was nice to come back home, work on anadromous fish, striped bass. Got to work on threatened and endangered fish such as the Atlantic sturgeon, coastal largemouth bass, shad, herring. So a lot of the fish species that I grew up angling for, which is really why I got into this line of work. So it was cool to be able to come full circle.
Not quite sure how many years were in between your master's and where you are now, but I imagine it was a pretty tough decision to leave a steady job with a state agency and jump back into the academic world. What led to that decision?
Absolutely. So I think it was 08 that I graduated University of Florida. So we're talking 11 or 12 years now since coming out of grad school. working in, you know, several state agencies. You know, I have a huge amount of respect for fisheries managers that really, they hone in on a specific area. And they really, they learn the resource, they love their resource, they manage it to the best of their ability within a certain region. I think what really gets me going is diversity in projects and research. And I think the research element is really what has made me gravitate back to the academic setting and come back for a PhD and with the potential of leading my own research in the future, potentially in academia. So that's, I think that's really what drew me back. And also I'd like to share my experience, with others. And it's fun being able to mentor, the younger generation. And I've found it, really gratifying to work with some of the assistant biologists who have worked for me in the past. And I'd like to do that on a broader scale and try to do some teaching as well as research. So that's why I got back into it.
Those are all good reasons. And in between the bouncing around jobs, you also were able to settle down and start a family. Was that also a pretty difficult decision, pulling your kids out of a school and moving them to a different location?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a major factor to take family considerations into play, you know, and that's part of the main reason why we moved back east was to get our children closer to our families. My wife's family's from Wilmington, Carolina. My family, all of my family's now in the Piedmont area, the Raleigh-Durham area in North Carolina. And so it was important for us to come back east. And so we had to weigh pros and cons as far as how, you know, what moves we were going to make. But, you know, we're pretty adventurous people. My wife and I, we've really bounced around a lot since grad school. So we're kind of, I think that's the way the younger generation has to do things now. It's not a situation as much anymore. I mean, there are pockets within the U.S. with fisheries management where this is the case, but it's not as much anymore where you come out of school, you'll have a job. That job may or may not be right there where you were anticipating to work, like a hometown type scenario. Some people are lucky and still get to do that now, but it's not as much the case. And you see a lot of people taking seasonal jobs, really trying to work their way up the totem pole. And a lot of times you have to move to promote within these agencies. Some people are willing to do that. Some people aren't. And we were willing to uproot and do what we needed to do. So that was just kind of our mindset. We'll go where we need to better my family and better my job and to ultimately get where it would be. Cause it is we, it's a family. And it's not an individual decision. It's funny, I've taken some of these structured decision-making workshops in the past, and I'm sitting there doing some structured decision-making models to figure out the next steps we need to take. So that's pretty fun. People laugh at me when I tell them that.
That's your state agency training going into being used. From your answer so far, it seems like you really enjoyed your time with each of the state agencies you worked for, so that it must have been a pretty special project to get you to pack up and move. And you said you wanted that mentorship role. So what is it exactly that you're working on at Clemson?
The work is out of Clemson University. My advisor is Dr. Troy Farmer. And what we're doing is we're setting up an acoustic array on the Cape Fear River in North Carolina. We're using this fairly new technology. It's been out a few years through FEMCO, but it's a high residence receiver, or HR2, where you can get sub-meter accuracy of fish movements. And the whole idea behind it is to see how fish are approaching a nature-like fishway that was constructed several years ago. And we're evaluating the effectiveness of that nature-like fishway, which was previously, it's where Lock and Dam 1 on the Cape Fear River is located. There's been some evaluations from North Carolina State and Dr. Hightower before he retired, and they found that the passage wasn't necessarily as effective as they hoped. So there, you know, it didn't meet the success criteria, the a priori success criteria. And so there was further need for evaluation And so we're trying to get at some movement, ecology, and behavior at a fine scale, both upstream and directly downstream of the fishway. There may be some modifications to the fishway. This is an Army Corps of Engineers funded project, and they're hoping to get in and do some modifications that would potentially allow fish to pass more efficient. And so if the timing all plays out right, which we're hoping to get a field season of pre-modification movements, and then they'll do the modification. And if everything works out right, we'll be able to get a year's worth of data after they do the modification. So that's our hope. We're looking at striped bass as our primary fish species, and also American shad. Those are the two fish species that we're...
Now, you mentioned if everything works out, you started there this past fall, so this was probably going to be your first spring or summer of collecting field data. How has the COVID-19 pandemic affected that plan?
Yeah, so it's affected in a pretty major way. There were some studies we were trying to get started. We were trying to do some tag retention studies with American shad. That had to go away because of the pandemic. You know, haven't been able to get out in the field and do the actual telemetry array and fish tagging. So, I mean, it's been a huge limiting factor with the pandemic, but you know, there's bigger things in this world than fish passage, as we're seeing on a daily basis here with this pandemic. So it'll be all right. I don't think it'll delay graduation, but it just allows me to do different things this spring, really, which really has allowed me to focus on this spring virtual conference, which I've been real happy to pitch in on. So it's opened the doors to some other stuff.
Yeah, and you're not alone. A lot of other state agencies have canceled their spring broodstock collection for walleye. That's a big thing here in the Midwest. A lot of states won't be stocking walleyes this coming spring. And a lot of state chapters of the American Fisheries Society have actually had to cancel their meetings because of the coronavirus. So AFS and yourself were pretty quick to jump in and set up this virtual conference. How did you get involved, and when did the idea of a virtual conference first pop into your mind?
Well, Nick, you know, me and you met when we both received the Emerging Leaders Award with AFS last year. So it was awesome to meet you in last year's meeting in Reno. And as part of that, we've been on this management committee within AFS, and Doug Austin, who's the executive director, looking for some possible ideas on how to approach, how to disseminate science and keep communication channels going even during this pandemic. You know, I had seen on various social media and some discussions, like, wouldn't it be great to have some type of virtual conference or virtual meeting? And so I just posed that to the group. AFS was quick to latch on, and we've got something really cool going now. You know, we've, in less than a month, we've put together 10 sessions, with about 10 talks in each session. And we had a really good first session yesterday, which highlighted the Alaska chapter. And so we had some really good talks coming out of Alaska on various fish species, lots of work on salmon, as you would expect. And it's just been a really big time learning experience for me, because, you know, I know a lot of folks in AFS at various levels have put on meetings themselves, but the people who haven't put on meetings, just a general membership, it's an enormous amount of effort. And so whenever somebody in your group puts together a meeting, give them five, tell them how great they're doing, because their leadership is allowing these meetings to happen. It doesn't just happen overnight. So it's been a huge learning curve for me, but I think people were genuinely happy with what they saw yesterday, and hopefully we'll continue over the next about a month. We'll be going strong Tuesdays and Thursdays from 1 to 4 through early to mid-May, depending on how many abstracts come in.
You mentioned this past Thursday, the Alaska chapter had their virtual meeting, and there's 10 different sessions total in the virtual conference. Are each of the sessions a different chapter or section meeting?
Yeah, so it's cool because we reached out to folks within this management committee and we said, okay, let's all try to come up with a list of meetings that have been canceled. Some of the ones that come to mind are obviously the big one, which was the Western Division, Washington, British Columbia chapter was part of that as well as a combined meeting. So that was canceled. The Florida chapter meeting was canceled. Tennessee, West Virginia, California, Nevada. I feel like the Tidewater chapter. I know the closures were occurring during the Michigan chapter meeting, so some of those folks weren't able to make it. So there is various meetings across the country that were canceled. There were, I'm not sure the exact name of the meeting, but there's a meeting that was held in South Africa that was canceled. So we'll have a speaker from South Africa give a talk as well. So this is an international meeting. We've had people from the U.S., people from Canada. We'll have South Africa. Who knows? Maybe we'll have some others as well.
We've said a few times there's 10 total sessions. How many different talks are there among all the sessions?
It'll range. Like next Tuesday, we'll have the Meet the Candidates webinar, which will give people the opportunity to hear from the two candidates that are up for election for AS. So that'll happen Tuesday from 1 to 2. And then from 2 to 4, we'll have 7 contributed talks, kind of a group of talks where there wasn't quite enough to do a full session for a specific chapter, but we still wanted to give those folks the opportunity. And then we'll have on Thursday will be the Florida chapter meeting, and that'll be a full slot of, I think, 10 talks. And then from then on out, it should be 10 talks each session. And each session is 3 hours. So, you know, we know people probably don't want to sit there for a full 8 hours watching talks all day long. So we really tried to spread this out. And it's a really neat way for people to spend their time. They can sit there. Their kids can be jumping around. Their dogs can be barking, whatever the case may be. But attendees can sit there and really enjoy some fishery science and kind of get them away from the whole pandemic. So we're hoping it's a nice outlet for people.
Yeah, you mentioned the Florida chapter meeting on Thursday the 23rd. One of the co-hosts, Julie Vecchio, will be talking in that session, so everyone should go check that out.
Oh, yeah.
I saw another one of the sessions was a poster session. How will that work in a virtual format?
That's scheduled for May the 6th. You know, we're up for suggestions on how that's going to go. The idea right now is to have those available and posted on a website, and people can view those and then be in contact with the presenters either through social media or email during a, 3 hour time slot. You know, we really tried to get through this first, this Thursday session. And so now I can really start thinking about the poster session as well, hone in on that. But I think, as you can tell, this has been unique because it's been such a dynamic and rapid planning process. I mean, we've been able to put this together within the last month. And, you know, a lot of AFS folks aren't used to this type of approach. And they're not, you know, there's a lot of things changing and day to day. And but after today, today's the final submission deadline for everything. So after today, it should get a lot more concrete. We should have, you know, everything lined up the way it should be, and we'll go with it.
You mentioned that the submissions deadline is today. We're actually recording on Friday the 17th. So by the time this episode airs, that'll be cut off. But if people want to tune into the conference on Tuesdays and Thursdays, where would they go to do that? And if they missed the Tuesday, Thursday timeline, can they go back and watch recorded versions of these presentations?
What's neat is this is a free conference. You know, we're using resources that AFS already had. So as far as costs, you know, this is staff time and volunteer time as far as myself and other Clemson students. This is a student-led virtual conference. Myself and Hannah Mulligan, Rachel Moore, and Logan Botiford are outstanding undergraduates in the Clemson Wildlife and Fisheries program. and they've really stepped up. And so this is really a collective effort from Clemson students to help AFS as a whole. And it's a really good partnership between the American Fisheries Society at the national level, working in conjunction with a student subunit. And really, they just allowed us to go with it and have worked with us nonstop to get this conference going. And so I couldn't be more happy with how it's turning out. And just real thankful for the opportunity to help. So,
are these presentations available on the AFS website?
If you know how to get to fisheries.org, you can get to this meeting. So fisheries.org is American Fisheries Society's website. There's a tab for meetings, and then there's a virtual conference, which is the fourth one down. And what it's going to show you, it's going to give information on our sponsors. We have received donations and sponsorships from the Florida chapter of the American Fisheries Society, the American Fisheries Society's education section, the Oregon chapter of the American Fisheries Society, and they all stepped up at the gold level. The Western Division of American Fisheries Society at the silver level, North Central Division, and Smith Root at the bronze level. And so all of the money that we receive through sponsorships and all of the donations that we receive as part of the registration process all go directly to the Hutton Junior Fisheries Program, which is awesome. So this has been a free meeting, but we've really tried to help fund a really important program to AFS. And so you go onto the website, you can see our description, and this is distinct and separate from the American Fisheries Society meeting planned for August. So this is totally different than AFS 150. So that's an important distinction. This is not a substitute for that. The whole objective of this virtual conference is to give presenters the opportunity to talk who would have not had that opportunity due to cancellations of their means. We had a great plenary presentation from Dr. Don Orth of Virginia Tech, and he talked about thoughts on virtual worlds. You can go and actually see a preliminary schedule with everything outlined on this website. On the website, you can register by which session that you want to see. And then you can look at different presentations through the presentation list, and you can view the abstracts. And what we really are trying to get people to do is, once you view these presentations, you know, have some Q&A with the presenter, email them, use their social media handles, and really ask some questions after these presentations are complete. And this is a little different than what people are used to. These are pre-recorded videos. So, you know, with the way this pandemic is going and the fact that so many people are online and connectivity could have been an issue, we thought it was best for presenters to pre-record their presentations. And so far, it's worked out really well. Each presenter has 15 minutes, and they just record their video through PowerPoint and submit it to us as an MP4 file, and then we use GoToWebinar and able to run those presentations directly in front of the whole webinar audience, which was up to about 260 people for our first session.
Yeah, I'm sure you've worked pretty closely with Lauren Mazza. Are those numbers comparable to previous AFS webinars?
You know, as far as I know, that's the largest number of people that we've had on a webinar in the history of all AFS webinars. So I think right now it's the AFS record. Hopefully we'll improve upon that in future sessions as people become more aware of it. We've plastered this all over Facebook, tried to put it on Twitter. We've got it, you know, AFS does their emails. So, you know, don't just delete the email coming from AFS. When it comes to your email box, you know, click on it, and read more about the virtual conference. So we have some specific session dates, and I'll go ahead and tell you that right now. As we talked about, Alaska chapter was April 16th. Our contributed paper talks, which will be that shorter session that I alluded to earlier, is April 21st. The Florida chapter will be April 23rd. There's a dedicated session to the Western Division meeting, Washington, British Columbia chapter, that joint meeting. That's going to be on two separate sessions on April 28th and 30th. There's going to probably be some carryover Western Division talks in combination with the California Nevada chapter on May 5th. We'll have our poster session on the 6th with kind of the platform and format to be determined. And then the Tidewater chapter has provided some really great talks, and that'll be May 7th. Depending on what we end up with the final submission count, we may add another session the following week. But as of right now, we are going to work through May the 7th.
Certainly sounds like you've put a fair share of work into this whole thing, and you deserve a round of applause when it's all finished. And I mean, you deserve a round of applause right now for even getting it started. But you and all of the AFS staff and your Clemson student subunit that have helped out all deserve a big hand for this.
Well, I think I can speak for everybody. We really appreciate that. And, you know, it's not just me. It's everybody. This is a collective effort. So, you know, kudos all around for all the organizers. And AFS has a really good structure. They have a lot of what's needed to put this type of conference on. So they're really the brains behind this as far as the getting this stuff into a workable format.
And you mentioned earlier in our talk that you really like that mentorship role. And another thing that I think is pretty important to you is the science communication. Yeah, I remember a few years ago in Atlantic City, you helped teach a workshop on science communication. And then this past summer, you even created a Facebook page and group for the Fish and Aquatic Science Publications page. I guess what made you think that a Facebook page would be a good platform for fishery scientists?
Well, I think it's a real passion for me. I enjoy publishing. I enjoy reading scientific literature. I know that's not the case with everybody because it can be bland at times. But I really like the scientific method and how that all works and flows. And then taking it beyond that is how do we make that easily consumable by the public, by the layperson who doesn't know all the scientific jargon. It's just a really big interest of mine, which is, it's almost like a hobby in itself, coupled with a job. So, you know, it's fun to do what you like to do in terms of your work. So, what I ended up doing, I saw a void. You know, I looked in several different places on Facebook and whatnot, and really didn't see anything really dedicated to scientific publications within the fish and aquatic science field. And so randomly on a Friday afternoon, back, I think it was in August or September of last year, like, I'm going to start this page up. And then, you know, it got some traction. We've probably had 60, 100 publications, individuals that have been shared. We're hovering, we're getting close to 1,000 members. And so anybody out there who has anything to do with fish and aquatic science and enjoys publishing and looking at published literature, and you're on Facebook, feel free to join. So yeah, science communication is really where we as fisheries professionals really need to focus on, because a lot of what we do is driven by public need. So we need to also be able to translate our science to the public to make it easily understand.
Well, I think you're doing a great job of it all so far, and as we've talked about in all the different topics we've covered in this interview, but now the tough part is over. We're down to the final five questions, and this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show, and we always start real simple, or I always start real simple, with what is your favorite fish?
That's a good question, because I actually, that's funny. I think striped bass are the pinnacle of the fisheries world. The anadromous, you know, sea run striped bass that utilize salt and fresh water. That's because I grew up with that fish. That species is probably why I'm doing what I'm doing. I grew up fishing, you know, I remember striped bass being really low abundances. There was some really good management actions across the Atlantic coast that came into play. And then the late 90s and the early 2000s, the striped bass population, at least in North Carolina, was on fire. And that was the peak of my fishing in high school, early college and stuff like that. So I would absolutely say the striped bass.
What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
I'd say my favorite memory from my career so far, and I think it has to do with the place as much as anything. I worked on a project in the Grand Canyon, and it was on the Little Colorado, and we used a helicopter. And so we were able to helicopter in and out, and just the scenery and people I was with, and just the beautiful blue water, because it was the sunlight bounces off the travertine when it's not turbid, and it's just this beautiful emerald blue, really light blue color that you wouldn't think would be in the desert. And so I think that would be a really good memory for me.
Talked a few times about how great your Grand Canyon experience was and all your other locations you worked, but what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
The dream job would be working in a research one institution, running my own research lab, bringing in some great and diverse graduate students. I would really like to stay in the Southeast. Florida was an amazing place. I really enjoyed Florida, but I could see myself working in a lot of different places. So I'd say having my own research lab in the next graduating 2024. So hopefully by 2025, I will be starting my new career in academia.
Just said you want your own research lab with grad students. So if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Money was not an issue. Wow. Well, that opens a lot of doors. If money was not an issue, I'd want to work on some mass scale problem that's impacting the entire world. I would probably focus on climate change and how that is impacting anadromous fish species all up and down the Atlantic coast, but also worldwide. I'd really want to hone in on what's affecting their run timing. Are there winners and losers in this whole climate scenario? And just so many questions that can be answered in terms of climate change and the winners and losers in the fish world. So I think that would be if I had one thing to work on, and that's big, but you mentioned unlimited funds. So if we could do that, that would be great in terms of fisheries.
And finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed in everyone's head, what would it be?
I think a lot of scientists have an issue with discussing their science with the general public. And I know a lot of people try to do that. A lot of scientists try and they don't really succeed. If I could program everybody's head to one thing, it would be de-jargonize your fisheries communication. And, you know, think about it in terms of what you do as a scientist will ultimately benefit the public in some way. And so be ready to talk about your work with the public. I'd say that would be the one thing I would say.
Well, Aaron, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and the work you're doing down at Clemson and with the American Fisheries Society planning this virtual conference. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Find me on Facebook if you'd like. I'm on there a lot. You know, you can reach me on my email, which is ajbunch@clemson.edu. That'd probably be one of the best ways to contact me.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Make sure to check out the special Voices of Coronavirus episode that will be released next week. If you have a good fishy story, joke, riddle, or anything fishy you want to share, just record it on your phone and email it to us or call into our voicemail at 856-347-4763. It's going to be a great episode that Julie's worked really hard on, and we want as many people as possible involved. And of course, you can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember to de-jargonize your science.